Welcome everyone to our November Intel Hub session. On this day we're going to have Dr. Patrick Walsh speak with us. He is a former intelligence analyst and now an associate professor in intelligence and security studies at the Australian Graduate School of Policing and Security. He's also an honorary visiting fellow at the Department of History, Politics, and International Relations at the University of Leicester. He's a senior researcher who has published over 30 publications on intelligence reform issues. His first book, Intelligence and Intelligence Analysis, examined a range of intelligence reform issues post 9/11 across Australia, Canada, New Zealand, the United States, and the United Kingdom. He's currently a chief investigator on two major research grants examining security intelligence collection post Snowden and another examining emerging cyber threats. His most recent book, which is the subject of this webinar, was released in September 2018. Patrick is looking forward to hearing all the questions that you have for him on his latest research, and he will look forward to taking those questions at the end of the presentation. So without further ado, I myself will go on mute, and I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Patrick.
Great. Thanks, Nicole, and thank you so much again for inviting me to be part of this really interesting webinar. And I hope welcome to everyone out there that who's come today. I know everyone's busy this time of year, regardless of what hemisphere you live in. And it is really lovely to be here today with you to just to do this webinar. So I've got a lot of material to get through, and I'll try and do that reasonably quickly so there's some time for questions. But if you need any translation from my Australian accent, maybe Nicole can intervene at some stage and if you can't quite get what I'm talking about. So really what I'll do is just briefly outline the book and the different sections of it. We'll spend quite a lot of time on the biosecurity, bioterrorism threat environment because that's really obviously important to people that are interested in intelligence to understand and to really is what we're still grappling with. So I'll talk a little bit about the objectives of the research, the book, the methodology, and some of these different chapters here as well. So that's the kind of the book. It's got the beautiful cover, which is Streaming DNA. It's Palgrave Macmillan. It's available for Palgrave Macmillan in ebook and paperbook. I'm much more in love with this cover than I was in my previous book, so hopefully that you'll like more than just the cover if your library gets it or you get it. So the objectives of really writing this book was probably fourfold. I wanted to give some sort of assessment of contemporary biosecurity and bioterrorism threats post 9/11. A lot's happened since the whole WMD and Iraq issue and whether Iraq had bioterrorism or capability and the whole intel failures that went around that. So where is this threat? It seems to me a lot of the intel community had gone pretty quiet on this for a range of reasons. So I wanted to understand where is that threat? And what's the role of intelligence now in supporting tactically, operationally, strategically, these sorts of threats. And, you know, the big question always, the thing that I'm interested in, because I guess a lot of my research is on capability and how do we improve the capability of the intel response. So, you know, is it effective, the intelligence response, the capability and processes for decision makers who have to make decisions on bio threats? And, you know, how can intelligence in the future play a role, particularly in this emerging threat space, which I'll talk a bit more about. So that's kind of the meat and potatoes of what we're going to do. So the question always is, well, you know, why another book on biosecurity and bioterrorism? Why this book? Why this research? And as Nicole pointed out, back in 2011, I wrote a book called Intelligence Analysis, and in that book I had a chapter on emerging intelligence practice, and so I call traditional intelligence practice national security and policing intelligence as the sort of traditional kinds of intelligence practice. But I wanted to look at ways that sort of policing and national security kind of work with more evolving intelligence contexts. So one of the areas I looked at was biosecurity. So I kind of got an interest in these issues of how does the science world and how do the sort of policing security world come together, probably back in that book in 2011. And since then, you can see I've written other publications about it. So, okay, so I'll move on. Everything okay so far? You can hear me all right? So what was the methodology for this book? It was an exploratory kind of approach, and I used an effective intelligence framework, which I developed in my first book, which intelligence analysis, which I won't go into, but I interviewed about 60 people for that book, senior intel people, and other folks, to ask them, well, what makes good intelligence capability? And I came up with a model, a framework. So I use that as a backbone for the book. But more importantly, someone's got something to say there, or?
No, Patrick, it seems that somebody else has come in on the line. Can whoever's on the conference line, can you please hang up so that Patrick can continue with his conversation? Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Nicole. So the main thing was that I do lots of interviews in my research, and I interviewed 25 people across the Five Eyes, a range of different roles, some scientists, some public health people. I was lucky enough to interview just in the dying days of the Obama administration, some people in the White House Office of Science and Technology. So I went into the Eisenhower executive offices near the White House, which is very cool. So they're the kind of people I interviewed. But, you know, 25 people does not make a huge representative sample of what's going on across the Five Eyes. So I recognize that, and obviously I use a lot of secondary data as well. But so what I'm about to say today should be seen as a sample of where we are with these issues rather than a complete representative accurate picture, if there ever was such a thing in this area. So we just sort of briefly talk through these objectives that I mentioned before, the four objectives. Now, when we think about post 9/11 biosecurity and bioterrorism threats, we really have to go back, you know, we have to contextualize it. We have to go back first to 1945, and we have to go back to the Cold War. And if anyone's studied bioweapons or has been in that area professionally in weapons of mass destruction, you'll know that it's really around 1945 that large sort of industrial countries were able to sort of at large industrial scale produce bioweapon agents such as anthrax, plague, tularemia, and some of these other nasty Category 1 bioagents, which are very lethal. Prior to 1945, efforts were made to make biological weapons, but they were fairly rudimentary in World War I. It wasn't until 1945, with the advances in microbiology, that you were able to make massive amounts of this stuff with fairly good accuracy, a fairly good quality, if you like, of the biological agents. So you had all the usual suspects developing state-based programs, which I've got there. It was President Nixon that ended back in the 70s, I think it was, ended the offensive biological program of the US. But the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union, kept on going with its program right up until sort of the late 90s, just before the fall of the Soviet Union. And really, Western intelligence didn't know that much about the bioweapons program in the Soviet Union. They know bits. But it wasn't until people like Ken Alibek, who was a senior scientist in the Stepnogorsk plant in Kazakhstan, who politically defected from the Soviet Union, where he was able to fill in some of the gaps that the US intel community had. And I've got there just an example of that, because they had these very large plants all over the former Soviet Union, and just one of six facilities contained 10 by 20,000 litres of fermenters that were able to make 1,000 tons of anthrax a year. So we're talking about a massive ability to make bioweapons. So the other thing quickly we've got to think about when we think about sort of, you know, the modern kind of threats to biosecurity and bioterrorism is back in the sort of Cold War period, we also had other states that were interested in bioweapons. So Iraq, Iran, Syria, North Korea, the obvious states that come to mind. And so each of these had varying level of success developing these programs. Iraq probably the most successful, although it was unable to fully weaponize and purify the anthrax needed to develop that sort of capability. So it never really got its full capability, and probably after the first Gulf War, most of that was destroyed by the United Nations inspection team certified that, although obviously that was revisited during 2002-2003 when Western powers, the US, UK and Australia, still held on to the belief that Iraq had that capability. So I suppose the other thing I would say about sort of 1945 and Cold War period, at the end of the Cold War, people in Washington and other Five Eyes countries around the world were worried about the consequence of the fall of the Soviet Union. So, you know, would you have scientists as like guns for hire with their knowledge because they've been working on these major plants throughout the Soviet Union? You had the Omshchenko sect that many people would remember in the late 90s that released sarin gas in the Tokyo subways and also experimented with plague and anthrax, which they had in a bucket on the roof of a building in Japan, and it was just letting out this sludge, which wasn't very successful because it wasn't very purified bioagent. And then you had the Timothy McVeighs of the world, the sort of the lone bomber threat, the sort of issue-motivated kind of crazy person. And then you, obviously after 9/11, as we came up to the end of the Cold War, the growth in transnational terrorism and Al-Qaeda, and we know what were their interests in this sort of bioweapons campaign. So you had someone like Zawahiri, for example, that was developing bioweapons in Afghanistan, and but that didn't, after the invasion of Afghanistan, they did find some. US forces found some, a laboratory in Kandahar and another facility which had very sort of rudimentary beginnings of a program, nothing that of great threat. but then sort of after 9/11, 6 days after 9/11, you had Amerithrax, and people would remember this in the United States in particular. America was already on high alert from the attacks of 9/11, and then, you know, 6 or 7 days later, you had these envelopes arriving in some media outlets on the East Coast, but also to a few senators in Congress. And these were just open because in those days, the mail system wasn't checked for these sorts of things, opened by people, and it released a very pure weapons-grade anthrax into the atmosphere, killing about half a dozen people from inhalation of anthrax and injuring several others, and, you know, closing the U.S. postal system down in Congress for several months. And I think the cleanup was cost over $2 billion. You then had like a 10-year protracted investigation by the FBI. And the guy here, Bruce Evans, committed suicide the day before he was going to be indicted by the FBI. So the FBI believe it was this guy who was had a 20-year career as an anthrax microbiology specialist at US ANMRID, which is the key US defense laboratory in Maryland. So he had a bit of a gripe about apparently about funding being reduced for bioterrorism research after the Cold War ended, and they believe that was the agenda, and he was trying to spark an alert, and he obviously had some issues, mental health issues. But Amerithrax is interesting because it's kind of like a break between the old state-sponsored terrorism and into the new world of potential different kinds of threats might be might be something that decision makers need to understand. It, not so much worry about what states are doing, but what about a scientist, for example, who has the capability to do this. So kind of like a bio-Unabomber, if I can put it that way. And the other interesting aspect of MRThrax was it was really the first time that you had the national security apparatus of a country like the FBI in the United States and the Center for Disease Control in the United States, the agency chiefly responsible for public health, coming together, sharing their different worlds of intelligence, the CDC with its epidemiology expertise, the FBI with investigative and intelligence expertise, coming together to find out, you know, who this guy was and forensically look at the anthrax and say, well, you know, where did this come from? So it's very fascinating. So the other thing, you know, when we talk about threats, we always, you know, seem to focus on bioterrorism, but we've also got to remember there's also biocrimes. Now, when we think criminal activity rather than terrorist activity, we normally think about there's a profit it's a revenge factor involved in the motivation for the crimes. So, you know, there's been various different kinds of biocrimes for multiple centuries, and some of these have been fairly unsophisticated. Ricin's been used for probably over a century to kill spouses. Ricin attacks still happen today. There was a couple of months ago, there was an attempted ricin attack through the mail system to the White House. It's the castor bean that, you know, has the disease, has the agent there that can kill you very quickly. And it's been used in, and ricin's been used in some political assassinations of most notably Georgi Markov, who was a Bulgarian dissident living in London, who was about to get on a bus in London and was stabbed in the back of his calf by an umbrella by a Bulgarian intelligence operative. And in the tip of that umbrella, there was a ricin pellet, so he died shortly after. So if we think about the threats in the sort of post-9/11 to current world, what are they? Well, there are multiple things we want to talk about here, and I'd love to go into details of some of these, but, you know, there's so many of them. I'm just trying to try and keep it fairly straightforward and simple. So one of the big things, I think, is when we think about biocrime, we think about individual attack on individual attack. But I think now in the criminal space, we are seeing more potentially sophisticated attacks involving maybe a group of criminals or a group of people conspiring, and not just against the individual, but against a whole community potentially. And we're seeing that in food security, which doesn't sound very sexy, but it's also an important issue. But if you think about how globalized food supply is around the world now. So we have these, you know, issue-motivated attacks, or we have people doing things criminally for profit. So in the right-hand corner, you've got melamine, which happened back in the sort of mid-2000s, which is a heavy metal that was used as a filler in Chinese baby food companies. It caused about 300,000 children, infants in China to get renal failure and killed several children as well. And there are other several cases at Fonterra in New Zealand, for example, big global New Zealand dairy company, where they found botulism, or what they thought was botulism, in its whey protein supply. It turned out later it wasn't, but the Chinese government, who obviously a big consumer of New Zealand dairy, shut down their supply of New Zealand dairy, and that obviously for a country like New Zealand, which its economy is primarily dairy and agriculture, did actually hurt the bottom line of New Zealand. And recently in Australia, you might have heard, we had a couple of months ago, we had a disgruntled farm worker working in Queensland, which is the northern state of Australia, and she was sticking pins in strawberries at the packing site. And these pins were turning up all over Australia, and they were, you know, people being hospitalised because they were chomping into a nice strawberry and, you know, getting stabbed in the mouth by a pin. And then there was some copycat versions of that, because there's always idiots around. And so there was hundreds of thousands of dollars of strawberries were recalled. And so that obviously is another example of this kind of thing I'm talking about. But, I mean, you know, leaving aside all the food security stuff, how do we characterise what might be the threats? say for the next 5 years or so. So really, no one actually, there's no consensus on, in a precise way, what these threats will be, because there's just so many variables. Like there are lots of other things that Intel analysts deal with, there are so many different drivers for things, and a lot of this stuff is still emerging as well. But what I say in the book is that you can probably look at it from two ways. You have stolen biological agents, and you have dual-use research in synthetic biology. So I'll just kind of go through that very quickly. So since the Bruce Ivins Amerifrax incident, naturally in the US and other Five Eyes countries and other European countries, there's been much more tightened control of access to laboratories. These are called BSL 3 to 5 laboratories that deal with work with only the most dangerous pathogens globally, things like Ebola, things like flu, you know, things where anthrax, things where there's either not great vaccines or no vaccines, and obviously they're very self-contained laboratories. People walk around in those spacesuits. Everything is counted and controlled. So there's been a lot more stringent control over laboratories, and a lot more stringent background checks, security checks on scientists working in these with these select agents. So. In a sense, then, you know, well, is this a scenario then where is this a physical environment where things could be stolen? Well, it seems to be really hard, increasingly hard to do so. But we saw, you know, in 2014, 2015 in the US, there was lots of vulnerabilities in biosafety, lapses in biosafety regulations in some of these labs. There was one in a laboratory where a 50-year-old jar of smallpox was found just in the filing cabinet when people were cleaning out the office. And as you know, smallpox has been eradicated from the world. And, you know, some people stockpile the vaccine still, but not a lot of people. But it hadn't been safely stored. There's been multiple other incidents, which you can read about in the book, which demonstrate vulnerability still in the way that these laboratories are run, but we're talking, you know, probably that kind of steal from that kind of laboratory sort of scenario is less the case. Partly because if something's stolen, you have greater microbial forensics, which can sort of say, oh, okay, that might look like it was synthesized in that sort of laboratory, so that makes it easier to track it. But it's possible that if not a substance is stolen, perhaps the intellectual property of how you do something might be stolen easy enough through, you know, hacking in a computer. So that's a big concern. And, you know, you've got to think, well, are terrorists going to do this? Are terrorists going to go into a US AMRID or a private sector laboratory and kind of steal a biological agent to use it? And then I kind of just think back to the Boston bombers. You know, what was it? Just a couple of pressure cookers. You think about the attack that happened in Melbourne a couple of weeks ago. It was just someone with a knife, you know, sort of trying to kill some police and some other people. So we're talking about low sophisticated attacks. Why would you go to all this trouble? So less likely that a terrorist will steal something from a biological laboratory, but there are vulnerabilities in states where there's an intersection globally of terrorism and where they have some sort of biotechnology or research capability in places like, for example, Pakistan, other parts of the Middle East, where they don't have quite the same stringent regulations. So the other scenario is dual-use research in synthetic biology. And really what this is about is in science we're seeing, and we'll talk a bit more about this, we're sort of seeing since 9/11 this massive development, like we are in cyber, massive development in technology that enables, you know, to replicate DNA much more quickly, to map genetic material much more quickly than we did sort of in the 80s before it. And so scientists can be working on synthesizing biological material and this same material could be weaponized. That's the concern, and it could be weaponized under cover of doing so-called legitimate research. So that's why it's sort of called dual use. Now, there's two kind of things to be worried about with this dual research. There's the insider. So there's the kind of Bruce Evans that we talked about in Amerithrax, who, you know, could be a skilled scientist, he could be some of knowledge, a lab technician, and who's developing, this might be part of a research team, and is past all the sort of security checks, but can still be there doing something nefarious, creating some dangerous substance under the veil of legitimate research. And the other thing is the sort of the outsider threat, where you might have what are considered gain-of-function experiments or dual-use experiments, which are highly at the cutting edge of science, but also highly dangerous. And we've had several examples of this where in synthetic biology, it has been the reconstruction, for example, of 1918 influenza virus, which killed about 50, 60 million people around the world. There's been the hypervirilization, if I can use that word, of various flus like H5N1 avian influenza, which was so many of these kinds of influenzas weren't transmissible naturally to humans, but scientists have worked ways that they can transmit them to surrogates like ferrets to sort of see how they would transmit to an animal that has similar DNA. And they do this because they want to make see how the virus mutates, and see how they can make much more stronger vaccines. So there's kind of a legitimacy to it. But the problem is, you know, people in the security world say, well, then you go off and publish that. Are you creating just a recipe for people, you know, bioterrorists, criminals and nut jobs who can then say, okay, well, I can make this. So obviously that's quite debatable, but it is a concern in the scientific community as well. And partly it's a concern because, as I said before, biology and research has industrialized so quickly over the last 10, 20 years. And you think about the human genome, you know, that was sequenced. It took about 10, 13 years to sequence and $500 million to sequence the complete genome of the human being. And that can be done now in 24 to 48 hours for $1,000 using a piece of bench equipment that I've got a picture of there. So it's just to give you a scale of how in a matter of 13 years, we can now map the whole genome very quickly. We can manipulate genes very quickly, massive amounts of benefits for science, potentially for cancer research and other kinds of vaccines, for more resistant agriculture, making better pharmaceuticals. There's a whole lot of reasons why to be involved in synthetic biology, and it is a big business, as I say. But the concern is, well, you know, what kind of threats will like anything, any increase in technology, look at cyber, look at other kinds of technology. As intelligence analysts, as people interested in security, we then have to think, well, how can this? What are security issues around this? Where potentially could threats come from? So I sort of in the book talk about three sort of broad areas. You've got the Unabomber, the bio Unabomber. So just by the fact that in countries like the U.S. or all the Five Eyes, but particularly the U.S., the growth in biotechnology and synthetic biology is off the charts. Just by sheer statistics, the amount of people working in these areas, you're going to have you know, people with bad intentions or crazy people who slip through the select agent testing and for whatever reason, whatever the agenda is, they are working on something they shouldn't work on for malevolent reasons. Then you've got kind of like the ID theft of biology, biological substances, and we see increasingly, you know, people getting their DNA testing and sending it off to a private laboratory or the government, you know, in criminal databases holding much more sort of DNA than, you know, 30 years ago. There's a potential for that material to be confiscated, stolen from someone, and someone else to take your identity, or to confound law enforcement agencies, for example, at a forensic site, by leaving your DNA there rather than theirs. So that's a sort of taking out someone's identity kind of scenario. And the third is biopiracy, is the ability to As we've heard recently, the last couple of days at a conference in China, you know, a scientist claiming that they've actually excluded HIV virus from two germ cells that make up an embryo by sort of doing some CRISPR gene editing of some DNA in around a gene, and so someone using that to make less resistant to some diseases, or making some drugs which are less resistant, or fooling around in some way that ends up in worse outcomes for people in terms of their health. So that's the sort of painting a picture of the sort of biothreat environment. So essentially, there's a lot we need to learn in this space, and I just want to sort of go quickly through other parts of the book as well so that you can get a sense of where we're going. So tasking coordination is something that I always talk about and seem to always talk about in the books I write. You know, you can't have intelligence without appropriate tasking from a decision maker, and that being coordinated, that tasking across the agency and the community broader. And I looked at that in terms of the biosecurity, bioterrorism environment across the Five Eyes. And what I kind of got a sense from people is decision makers seem to be pretty disengaged on bioterrorism issues. So, you know, you may want to, at the end of this, argue against that, and maybe you've got better knowledge than I have. But certainly in the civilian agencies, not so much in the defence agencies, which have to keep a watching brief on this for protection of their forces, the people I talk to seem to be implying that it's still looked at, but not like it was obviously back in the Amerithrax days or in the WMD in Iraq days. It's kind of considered a bit of a dead issue. And so decision makers aren't asking for it like they used to, or don't know perhaps what they want to ask for. And this impacts on the capability and the way the intelligence community is organised. And what comes from that is if you aren't tasking on it, if you're not focused on it, if you're not coordinating the response out, collection and analytical response out, then you have an issue of understanding the risk and threat in a more precise way. And that's what we don't seem to have at the moment, is understanding more acutely, calibrating the risk and threats, given this evolving, sophisticated advancements in biotechnology and synthetic biology. If we talked about collection, I went through all these different traditional collection methods that we all know, and the thing is, you know, biosecurity and bioterrorism is such a huge spectrum. You have anything from potential to exploit criminally or for terrorist purposes, agriculture, to human health, to border issues around things being brought in that might impact on your biosecurity, up to sort of obviously sort of classical sort of terrorism. So it does depend on what the kind of threat is and what the context is. So some of the old kind of traditional Cold War figuring kind of geospatial ways of looking at these issues may not be as relevant as more open source material, and certainly accessing scientific knowledge through peer review sources, epidemiology and microbial forensics, particularly the latter, which seems to have been very helpful over during the Amerithrax and since. And there are certainly capability gaps. Although, as I said, microbial forensics has been a pretty good thing, there are gaps in knowledge there that need to be closed, gaps in technology. There's the dark web and artificial intelligence, which are all things that the intel community are working with, but I doubt very much if they're really fully exploiting them in terms of biosecurity and bioterrorism. And I think that would be a really good thing to do if they could do that. And the other problem with collection, of course, we've had the Snowden drama, and that's obviously changed in all Five Eyes countries and European countries, how intelligence agencies operate, how do they respond to the public, how do they maintain trust, how do they collect intelligence ethically but still efficaciously is really a struggle for our intel communities, and how to take public trust along in liberal democracies. So you've got sort of, you know, telecommunication companies encrypting, doubly encrypting their smartphones, their different kinds of social media, and you hear a lot of, you know, intel people talking about the going dark factor. And I think I heard a quote the other day, someone in the FBI said, well, we've already gone dark. In Australia, there's some legislation that's being considered in the Australian Parliament right now about, you know, forcing telco providers to provide decryption if required. So that all plays into the what kind of collection we can get done. I looked at analysis as well, and it's clear that after 9/11, a lot of the bureaucratic restructuring of our intelligence communities has impacted on how the communities deal with bio threats, how they understand them. So I think you've got pockets of excellence in some agencies. I think in the DIA in the US, there's a you know, about nine people, I was told, seven or nine people working on these issues. CIA's always got people working on them. But other agencies, less so. And so it's not necessarily the number of people, but it's, you know, the kind of people working on them. Have you got the right mix of people? And how are they working in concert with other agencies? So that's a concern, and perhaps we can talk more about that. But I mean, the FBI have done some good stuff over the last 10 years or more, trying to outreach to the intel community, but also the private sector as well. Moving right along. Another issue which I talk a lot about in my work is governance. It's how and governance has two aspects. There's the external aspect, which is what which our governments sort of force on the community in terms of budgetary and declarations of what you're going to do or not do through collection priorities and so on. And you have internal governance, which is more the control of leaders of agencies and communities who actually work out not only what you're going to do, but how it's going to be done, and how to avoid confliction with other agencies. How do you bring integrate collection analytical capabilities together within your agency and across your agency? And I would say that governance in this space, and indeed a lot of spaces in intelligence, is not optimal. And even though there's been a lot of money spent in U.S. defense and other countries over the years, that money is not necessarily being spent in a coordinated way where the whole of the community could benefit from it. So that's a sort of example of a governance issue. And this has been picked up a lot in the last couple of years, particularly in the US, by Blue Ribbon panel reports that have been done by senior members of former administrations saying that there needs to be a more coordinated response to biodefense in the US. I suppose on the governance thing is that what it's about is making sure that you have a senior cabinet minister that leads a coordination of these biosecurity issues right at the centre of government, and that includes having a strategy underneath that for how the intel community is going to work with the whole of the other agencies, the public health agencies, the research universities, the agricultural and veterinarian people, the border people, the private sector laboratories and researchers that are dealing with in biotechnology. So how do you have that broad response, which is what you need? And that's what a health security strategy should be. And within that, you need a National Health Security Intelligence Officer, kind of like you have a National Intelligence Officer, ODNI, for the different sort of main threat priorities. And you notice I don't call it biodefense, I call it health security, because you can't sort of hunt for terrorists, bioterrorists, or biocriminals without being closely aligned and embedded with public health, because ultimately you're not going to know the release of some biological hazard has been done intentionally or unintentionally. So you have to understand the disease dynamics, and only the clinicians and epidemiologists will understand those things. So how do you bring yourself together with the epidemiologists in a much more health security focus? That's a bit of a struggle at the moment, I think. So where are we now? Effectiveness of IC response. So in summary, there are governance issues across the Five Eyes. These are about leadership, how you arrange your agencies, what kind of analysts you have, what kind of collection you have, how do you work across within and across the Five Eyes. There's a lot of meetings, as you know, in the Five Eyes. At the national security and law enforcement level, they discuss a range of issues. And I'm sure biosecurity comes up from time to time, but I suspect not very often. You've also got intelligence stakeholder issues, and you've also got oversight and accountability issues, which are a bit of a problem. So in terms of intelligence and stakeholders, I spend a whole chapter on this. You can't one of the points I'm making about this book is, it seems so obvious, but it's not quite where it needs to be. You need, the intel community needs to look at strategically at bringing in stakeholders from a range of different levels. So you've got multilateral, which is all the sort of biological weapons convention, global health security, all the sort of multilateral WHO stuff that's being done. You've got the private sector that's also got to be brought in, you know, researchers, and IARPA is doing a bit of work in this area and Project Felix. You've got the public health people I was talking about, the first responders, they all have to come in, and it has to be done in a coordinated sort of way, which is currently kind of not really being done at the moment across the Five Eyes. And the other thing is, when you're thinking strategically about what stakeholders you need, you've got to think, you know, what's the function and the role of intelligence at a prevention level, at a disruption level, at a treatment level for these threats? And what stakeholders you'll bring in for prevention will be quite different to what you might bring in for disruption and treatment. So it's trying to understand how does the intel community reach out to appropriate stakeholders for the prevention, disruption, treatment of bio threats and risks. Now, accountability and oversight is a big deal in intelligence, as we all know. I'm involved in a big grant at the moment, looking at as Nicole said, at looking at security intelligence collection post Snowden across the Five Eyes, and we're going to be running a few workshops talking about those sorts of issues. So, in a sense, biosecurity and bioterrorism is just a sort of a subset of those broader issues around intelligence capability and oversight that we see in the broader world of intelligence. And the problem is we have these diverse range of legislation. We have legislation for weapons of mass destruction, biosecurity, terrorism, cyber, agriculture, and they all kind of talk a little bit about bio threats, obviously. And some of them are more explicit about the role of intelligence in each of them. Some are quite dated. Some of them are duplicative. And that's a problem. And so there needs to be much more deconfliction of legislation. And we're doing that in Australia at the moment with, there's a big inquiry at the moment about how can we deconflict intelligence legislation in Australia. I wish they look at this issue. I don't know if they're going to, but it's more broadly how does the Australian intelligence community deconflict its multiple bits of legislation to make it more clear what the function and role of the intelligence community are against different threats. Now, the regulation of dual-use research remains really difficult. So there's been lots of cases over the last 10 years where the National Institute of Health have funded these very dangerous experiments I've talked to you before about, you know, the influenza virus and trying to find a way it can jump from one species to another to work out how you can make better vaccines. And some of that research went up to the National, I always forget its name, the Biosecurity Oversight Body in the US, and they said, well, no, you can't publish it. You know, it's basically a recipe for terrorism. And eventually, because there were some other people involved in it who weren't from the US, who weren't being funded by the US, they said, well, we're entitled to publish it. That's what scientists do. You can't stop us. It's got to be transparent. So there's a lot of debate over the last couple of years about how do you regulate this dual-use research so you don't stop people doing legitimate research that can help come up with life-saving vaccines or help cure cancer or whatever or get rid of nasty genetic defects. But there's got to be some regulation on it from an ethical point of view and from a, you know, from a security point of view. And at the moment, we don't have that. And you can, as I said before, that case in China at the moment where there's the second conference of genetic editing going on, and there's all these international people there sort of dismayed that, you know, this Chinese scientist decided that he was going to fool around with this human genome, and has claimed that he's created an embryo that is HIV-free because one of the parents was HIV positive. So that raises all sorts of ethical and security issues, and I think the Intel community will have a role to play in greater regulation in this space, just like they have in to some extent in cyber. So what's the role of the Intel community in managing biothreats and risk in the future? Well, I think at the moment, in some Five Eyes countries, there isn't a great focus on Intel reform, meaningful Intel reform, for political reasons or out of sheer neglect, which sadly, and I don't see necessary continuing some of these governance issues I've raised getting much traction over the next couple of years. Others may be so, but you know, Britain at the moment has a massive problem with Brexit and its identity. There is some transformation going on in Australia of our community at the moment, but I don't know if they are going to look at some of these biosecurity, bioterrorism issues, but I certainly think they should. And I think that there's something certainly more that the Five Eyes community should be doing in this space to... my main concern is that, you know, it's like cyber. 10 years ago, I think our community, our tel communities, kind of didn't really ride the wave of cyber sufficiently well, and now we're still trying to develop a workforce within our Intel community to deal with cyber. And what I worry about is with the massive changes in biotechnology, yes, you can always ask scientists, yes, you can always bring in experts, but you still have to have a core capability within your community, and you still have to work out who outside of those stakeholders strategically you should be building relationships with, and how can you sponsor research that's both public health focused and also security focused. And I just don't think we're there at the moment, and that concerns me, despite the fact that biosecurity and bioterrorism are sort of low probability, high impact threats. So I think I'm going to leave it there. I think that's probably enough, isn't it?
Yeah, that was a wonderful overview and discussion, Patrick. Thank you so much for that. If anybody has any questions in the chat, now would be the time to raise them. But I see people are starting to write frantically, so let's see what comes up. So, Patrick, just for my own curiosity, as you were doing work on the book, what surprised you the most about the research as it started unfolding?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think when you write a book sometimes, you're always thinking you're a bit of a fraud because you think, even though I've been writing on this stuff and I've published on this, I'm not a biological scientist. I'm an Intel, ex-Intel analyst. I'm an Intel capability guy. How can I translate some of that world into for analysts that, you know, like myself, that don't understand that world? So I think it's just the learning that I got trying to talk to different scientists, talk to different clinical people to get their perspective, to sort of check my own biases about the threats and how threats might develop. So I think I learn a lot, but I think I kind of thought, even though I didn't interview a lot of people, I thought, there must be more going on than there is. And I think I didn't interview anyone in the military space. That's possibly there is some stuff going on. But largely in the civil intel communities across the Five Eyes, I got the distinct impression there's not much going on in this space. That worries me. And one of the things also that I was very careful to do in the book in terms of talking about threats you get a lot of people that write about bioterrorism, and they're sort of like Chicken Little, the sky's falling, you know, bad guys are going to use every bit of new technology, technology that's out there, which of course I don't believe in. But then you get also these other people say, no, it's too complicated, they won't use it. But I guess the point is, there are people that can use this stuff, and you've got the crazy scientists, and you've got, you just need one crazy scientist, really, to make something sufficiently bad that there's no vaccine for, and you've got a major, a major crisis. So I think it's that we don't understand where the threat is. There's so much disagreement between scientists what could be, used as a threat as well. But we can only get more precision around that if we, have capability within our communities, develop that capability, but also strategically work out how do we build that scaffolding of scientific and clinical knowledge around it to make sure we have a better precise understanding of bio threats and risks.
Yeah, that's interesting. I know one of our faculty at APUS, Dr. Casey Skavork, does work with scientists in BSL 4 and 5 labs for biosurity, just to ensure that things remain incident-free. So I definitely, I'm sure he could definitely speak to some of the different disconnects and the challenges of assessing that risk as well. Dr. Branham has said that she's curious about the pushback hearing if there was any pushback from the intelligence and security communities on taking a health security approach to considering this issue, since it seems to be written off by many people as a human rights thing rather than some other type of risk.
That's a very good question. Look, I think there is, I got a sense of it, I don't know how bad it is, but I got a sense that, you have people in the intel community that think very much about state-based bioweapons programs still. When they think about, the dangers for biosecurity and bioterrorism, they're thinking, someone making anthrax, putting it in a warhead and lobbing it over to another country. They're very, sort of have a very Cold War mentality about it. Whereas, what I've tried to sort of say when I was talking about the threats, there are lots of different ways that you can weaponize biology, and increasingly it's not making anthrax in laboratories, it's actually making something synthetically, which is it's even harder to trace, and doing something with that, polluting a water supply or, sort of dealing with food security issues or whatever it is. So I think there's a bit of disconnect, and then you get the scientists, the clinicians, who have who look at it epidemiologically as what are the incidents, the morbidity and mortality of disease. They're looking at the stats, looking at the signs that something might become a pandemic. So they're looking at it in a very sort of clinical perspective, and the two worlds are kind of speaking across each other. And they're not actually together working out, and I take the point. I mean, I'm very much a health security kind of focused guy. And you'll read a lot of books and they'll say, we have to understand biosecurity and bioterrorism as a one health continuum. So that means animal health, human health, everything has to be considered one because everything can be affected. So a lot of people talk about that rhetoric, but they don't actually, kind of subscribe to it. It just sounds good. And I think what's got to happen, and what if you look at the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, it killed about 10,000 people back in 2014, wasn't it? Something like that. Killed about 10,000 people, and WHO was very slow to realise when they finally got their act together that it wasn't just about providing a clinical response to that; it was also a whole of country response, because these countries in West Africa, Sierra Leone, Gambia, these sort of places had very, very vulnerable national public health systems and very, very vulnerable government sector anyway, so that the disease was going to crush and set back for years the GNP of these countries, their ability to, for even political stability in some cases. So these are national security issues. They're not just some quirky little health problem, and that's the way I look at it. And increasingly, you have and the Germans at the moment are I think they're on the UN Security Council. They are setting up a global health security initiative, which I'm been asked to be part of. And they're bringing together doctors and public health people and veterinary people and security people. And what they're trying to do is look at health security issues much more earlier, using some of the intel stuff that we use in national security around early warning indicators. You know, how do we actually get ahead of a pandemic rolling up on your doorstep? You know, the trouble is the CDC will and a lot of public health, the way they're trained, they'll go, hang on a minute, we've got to go over there and test the stuff and come back to our laboratory and confirm it first before you can make any announcement about a potential pandemic. Whereas what the global health security people are saying is, well, yeah, you have to do that, but what about, you know, monitoring more carefully, more systematically, the social media, the news in these countries for, you know, spikes in people going to doctors, people talking about symptoms and flus and so on. So you know, this is where I think the conversation needs to be more of, bringing those two worlds together. And I think some of the public health people are worried because they think, oh, we don't want our people out in the field to be considered collectors in the intelligence sense, you know, and put in harm's way, particularly if they're working for like Medicine Sans Frontières. But we're certainly not advocating for that. But what some of the things we can bring over from the intelligence sort of tradecraft, we can bring into the public health space and have a bit more of a better understanding of trajectory of disease, and then hopefully from that work out, well, is this just a normal, you know, pandemic, or is there something nasty happening here that's sort of a security threat?
Yeah, I think that's really fascinating, especially when you start to think about from the health standpoint of the worry about them being put into a position of being collectors, and of course that then will also cross, you know, ethical and legal boundaries as well. And it's interesting. I think Matt mentioned in the chat earlier as well that there seems to be a deficit of people really well versed in the subject area that are both that can walk in both worlds, if that makes sense.
I think that's right. I think it's starting to turn around, and some, I mean, even WHO now is, I think it's writing some health security regulations. So they're because the UN obviously has always been anti-intel, anti anything that suggests I've sort of been involved in intel for a range of reasons. But I think what you're getting is more recognition that we need to train people who might be clinicians in security issues, and security people need to understand obviously more the clinical, not to be a doctor, but to understand the public health world and how those two things can come together. And this Global Health Security Alliance, which is only just set up formally probably about 2 months ago in a bar in Germany, I believe, which is where all good things probably should be brought into the world. I understand the German government is going to put lots of money into it because, you know, global health is a big concern for Germany and Europe, and you know, more they think they can make an impact in this space. So it's kind of like watch this space, but you do need people to understand both of these worlds, and you know, the intel community. I don't know. I think I don't know what kind of people are being recruited. Probably not the right people.
Yeah, it does leave room for that question, Patrick. I do want to be respectful of your time. I know we're running up running up on that hour of close now. But thank you so much for sharing your work with us. I think this was really informative. I see people chatting in the chat talking about new courses that can be made, and of course concentration areas just on this subject matter alone. So thank you for attending, and I do want to announce that we will be having another Intel Hub session in December. David, I believe that we set up December 19th as that date, so it should be just before people start wandering away for the holidays, but I will make sure that announcement gets out to everyone. in the next couple days, and we'll move forward there. So thank you all so much for attending today, and we look forward to seeing you again soon.
Okay, well, thanks for the opportunity, and thanks everyone for taking the time to listen.
Beep.